We're going to actually talk about the last three principles in this module. So we're going to talk about how we're going to work with memory, how we're going to work with the structured markup, and then how to execute your code more efficiently. So these are the three things we will talk about: memory, structured markup, and then know what your application is doing.
All right, so I'm going to take over and talk about staying lean, your memory usage. So I'll be mentioning something called GC. What that stands for is garbage collection. So when you're working with objects, you have to eventually collect the objects that aren't being used. And that process is called garbage collection. So if you have a DOM element that's been removed from the page, if you have a configuration object that you use to pass to a JavaScript function, once that object is no longer being referenced, it gets cleaned up by the garbage collector to free that memory for other things. The effect of GC, though, so the side effect of that garbage collection is it has to pause the UI frame, so stop the world, in other words, and that constitutes to things like scroll lag. So if you're doing a lot of GC while you're trying to scroll your social media feed, or if you have a bunch of animation on your page or a game and a GC pause occurs, it can lower the frame rate and cause stuttering to happen. It also can look like your application is hanging or pausing for a time, depending on how severe the GC pause is. So that's the side effects. This is an overview of the garbage collection execution pipeline, or the garbage collection flow. Now this is really for IE specific, so Chakra specific, but all browsers have a garbage collector, a garbage collector of some kind. In this case, IE and Chakra, we have a garbage collector that works on multiple threads. And so in this case, there's the foreground thread, which is the thing that affects your UI. So remember from the F12 tools, we saw that there was the UI thread, and then you could see the GC being done on a background thread. So in this case, there is the GC is started, and then it goes immediately to a background thread to do other processing like marking and rescanning, and then eventually has to come back to the foreground thread to do a final pass before it is collected. And so whenever we're trying to improve GC, we're always trying to push more work to the background thread so it does not disturb your foreground. So anytime we talk about optimizations or reducing GC pause, it's reducing the amount of time the GC has to stay on the foreground thread or the UI thread. Cool. So what triggers a GC? Every time you work with your JavaScript API, you may pass a JavaScript object, you may be coercing values from one type to another type, or accessing properties on a primitive where it has to box and unbox values, and that creates implicit allocations for objects that are then having to be garbage collected. You can also have this whenever you're dealing with, like I mentioned before, DOM elements is a good way to see your GC kick in for collecting DOM elements, because they tend to be larger, they tend to store a little bit more data on them. It also happens when your pool of allocated objects need to be cleaned. So the gist is, try to reduce your allocations, and that should help reduce the amount of pauses that need to occur to clean up those allocations at a future time. So this always, the slide says, hey, be careful about the allocations in your app. Every allocation brings you closer to that GC pause. Now, this isn't something that you want to try to manage on your own. I would say, hey, let the engine deal with your objects. There are some rare cases where you may want to use object pools, and we'll talk about that technique a little bit later. But generally speaking, the engine is great at what it does when it comes to GC, but you need to understand what's causing your GC, so maybe you can help avoid that in the future. So best practices for staying lean. Avoid unnecessary object creation. So later on we'll have a demo where every turn of the character on screen creates a new object with new properties, and you can avoid that. So if you have an API that's excessively object-oriented, where you're creating a bunch of instances, or you're doing a lot of implicit coercion, maybe that's creating unnecessary objects for you, and so you can clean that up and help reduce your GC pause. For example, in my popcorn demo, I made sure that I had a fixed number of particles on the screen, and when they were done being used, I would clean them up. So that means when I would then pop less popcorn, I wasn't still holding on to the references to, let's say, the 500 other kernels. It was just the 10 or 20 kernels for the smaller popcorn. So you need to be aware of the particles or the objects that you have and the instances that you have and how to clean them up. JavaScript libraries provide APIs for you to use. So in this case, one of the tips is managing your event handlers. Event handlers are great and necessary for your web app. But what they can do is they closure capture objects. So if they have access to an object in a higher scope, that means that object is not going to be released because it's that event handler exists and still technically has access to that object. So JavaScript libraries like jQuery provide you APIs that you can use to clean them up. So for example, with jQuery, it would be the remove methods will actually remove the DOM element from the page, but also crawl the DOM element and all of its child elements and clean up all of the event handler data associated with it, so you can help avoid having that single page memory leak. As I mentioned before, reducing intermediate objects and implicit allocations is also a way to keep your memory lean and help reduce the number of GC pauses that occur. So cool. Now the next section is efficient structured markup, and so I'll pass that on.
Exactly. So we're going to actually using the best practice in the keep the memory lane in our last module when we do the case study. So efficiently markup using the structured markup. So this is really some of the things you probably have heard about that before. It go back to Steve Souder's 13 rules at the beginning, but some of the rules are still very true, so we want to re-emphasize that. So first one is link your style sheet at the top of the page instead of put it somewhere else. So the reason is very simple. It's really related to the page loading and also the perceived performance. Say for example, you have a style sheet, and then you always want to actually make sure the browser knows what's the style, what's the characteristics, of that page, so that it could start to show something, right? Rather than you leave it somewhere else, because it takes a little time to actually parsing your CSS and then really create an internal CSS data structure. So it's the best to put it at the beginning, so your end user will start to see something for the page loading.
But besides all of that, and the cost of having it to calculate the flow of the format and the layout of all the page, mm-hmm. and then having to redo that once it hits the style,
right.
You also avoid the flash of unstyled content. So right. If you've ever visited a page with the CSS disabled, it looks very basic and mm-hmm. very, very primitive.
Right.
And if you have your style sheets located at other locations in the page, then they'll see that basic structured setup first instead of the rich styled mm-hmm. markup that you would normally see.
True. Very true. So continued from the previous slide, which is never link style sheet at the bottom. Right, so we already say we should put it on the top. So the reason we don't want to put it on the bottom is maybe before that you have a lot of, JavaScript, the images you need to load. So because all those content is not going to tell you what to show on the screen, right? So the browser basically wait for your style sheet to be loaded so they could actually set up the background and all those things. But because they don't know anything about that, so you're going to see a blank page. Right. If it takes very long, then your end user is going to think, oh, this site is dead, right? Because I didn't see anything for maybe, nowadays people are not that patient, right? If you have it more than like a 5 or 3 seconds, people are going to say, oh, this site is not working, right? So make sure you never leave the style sheet at the bottom. You want to put it on top, right? So that's the first rule. Second thing is about ad import. I don't really think it's really necessary nowadays with the modern browsers. You have to stay using the ad import because there are some other ways, better ways of doing that. Because when you actually put ad import, you basically will block the whole UI thread. You will just say, let me actually getting this style sheet from the net, and then let me actually parsing it and create the internal CSS data structure. You have to wait the UI thread finish up all those things, then it could move on to the next statement. So this will be actually blocking your UI thread and slow down your performance quite a bit, and you will see quite a bit of delay because it's a CSS, right? If you don't see CSS, there's not much going on there. So make sure if you could avoid using add import, try to avoid it. Go back to your code, look at it, especially your old code. See if you're still using add import there. Try to avoid them.
CSS preprocessors may also be able to help you out with this as well. Because at the time, they're not only adding things like CSS prefixes, but they're also can handle concatenating your CSS files together, minifying and optimizing and reducing duplicate styles as well.
So true.
It may be a way to avoid the cost of the import.
Right, exactly. Some other ways to do that. So the other things I want to share with you is the embedded inline style. Okay, so this is sort of a common mistake people make if you look at the sample on the slide. It's very tempting, right? I want to fix a quick bug, or I want to just put a little property onto it, put a little color onto that. So instead of doing a traditional external CSS, I just put it inline, right? I would just say, that's an easy fix, get it done, right? Couple of minutes. Well, that's very true. You could just do it at your convenience, but you may not notice that in order to do the embedded inline style, you actually have to actually introduce another container, which is a CSS container. So during this piece of code, when they process it, the browser actually have to sort of switch in back between the HTML markup container and the CSS container. So you have to do back and forth between these containers. Hence, you know, even for you, it's really convenient to put a little code like this, but you're actually wasting some resource just by switching back and forth with the HTML and CSS container, whereas you could actually putting it into external style sheet to save some resource. So this is something you may want to watch out, check your code.
And I'll say that this falls under the mileage may vary section because there are performance techniques you can use. For example, just loading the styles needed to get the content to display before the page fold. There's utilities out there that will actually crawl your CSS and your DOM and decide where the styles need to stop before the page, before that first page fold, and then inline those styles directly into your page so there's not an HTTP request, which is again going back to that balancing act between the cost of an HTTP request and the cost of your style. To get that first impression, the display to glass as fast as possible. So this one is a little bit of your mileage may vary. There's sometimes where this technique can come in handy, but again, you wouldn't put the style in the body of the page. It would be up in the head as normal good practices would promote. But there may be a place for this, though I wouldn't say don't abuse the inline style. It's certainly good for just that narrow use case there.
Right, it is very much context-based.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so next is actually something I think is pretty common. You have a sort of like a pretty large-scale project, a lot of things, style sheets you need to prepare for various of pages. And then maybe for the convenience, or maybe you just careless, you actually dump a bunch of CSS style sheet in the front, right? It will just say, okay, I know I probably will need these XYZ style sheet for maybe the first five pages. But then what you're doing is it's basically say in the startup page, you want actually what we call using a lazy initialization. We want to load as less content, enough content to show this page. You don't want to put all the CSS style, right, in the front. Say, for example, you only use 10 or 20% of the CSS, but you're loading so many CSS file. But then the CSS, it does take time to load it from network, does take time to parsing and processing, right? So you're wasting 90% of time to do something you're not going to even need it for your first page, right? So this is really a bad practice. You only include all the necessary styles in your particular HTML. You don't want to include everything because there's a global page, there's a little home page, there's a subpage. So you have to sort of understand the details.
And to have a callback to some of the stats we talked about earlier, remember how many of the resources on your page may not be cached properly anyways, and so you're not only getting all the styles for multiple pages which may or may not be viewed, they may or may not also be cached too. So you may say, well, hey, if caching is done properly, it's only a one-time hit, but it's still the very first thing your user is going to be seeing. And it's the balance there is you're betting on the wrong thing. You're saying, hey, this is they're going to visit all of these pages, and so maybe it'll pay off. But really, you should keep in mind that just show and get enough on the page for that page, for the context of that page, so it will load faster, and you're not having to pay this unnecessary cost.
True. Okay, so same thing. We talk about our CSS. We talk about JavaScript now. Remember, this is the second largest kind of resource we need to download from the web. So where should we put our JavaScript, right? So rule number one is you should always link your JavaScript at the end of the file, like here, right? This is the right place to put your JavaScript. Same thing. What happened is the CSS, we want to get it as early as possible. We want to know what's going on, the layout of that page and so on. Now, JavaScript, you know, you probably don't need to get it and passing immediately in order to show something on the front page, right? So you want to actually leave it towards end. You want to actually getting the images, getting the CSS, do all the nice layout, and then you want to look into the CSS, the JavaScript, you could load it from the web and processing that, and to see if there's any action I need to do, if there's any function or event handling I need to do. But so always leave it towards the end of the file.
Right, because JavaScript is usually supplemental to the actual content on the page, and so you don't want that blocking anything that's actually essential. Something I've also mentioned earlier is that in every one of these profiles for like network, we've shown DOM content loaded, and that's the time where your JavaScript can actually interact with the DOM. But if your JavaScript is loaded at the very end of the page, then the DOM for all of those the elements above it has already been loaded. So by virtue of it being at the very bottom, it's reasonably safe to know that the DOM is loaded, and so you can interact with it immediately without having to add another event listener to the page. There are edge cases, but it is something kind of an unintended bonus of being able to stick your code at the bottom of the page.
Right.
You can interact with the DOM sooner.
Sure. And then obviously the other thing to go back is never, never link your JavaScript in the header, right? You all know the consequence. If I leave the JavaScript, you know, in the header even before CSS, that means I have to load the JavaScript, I have to process that and pass that, and I have to spend quite a bit of resource. And then that's a time when you see the blank screen. You're not going to see anything, right? So because this is going to block the UI thread until you get a CSS. So always put it in the bottom, put a JavaScript in the header.
And I'd add to this is that external scripts, so say you have scripts to add your social media buttons on your website, you certainly wouldn't want to put those up front before all the rest of your content, because their service may be down, which means that that page and that resource is holding up and causing your page to sit at a blank screen while it's failing to connect or get the resource. And so usually what I do for something like social media buttons is I use JavaScript at the very end of the page to dynamically add script. And I think later on we'll be talking about ways to add script on demand to help avoid load time.
True. Okay, so you probably ask me, you know, I understand, okay, there's a particular position you need to leave your CSS right in the header, and then JavaScript to the bottom, right in the body. So what is the benchmark tells us, right? What's the end result? So let's actually take a look at this benchmark. So this is actually exactly what we did. We test the JavaScript, and the first case is we leave the JavaScript in the header. Second case is we leave the JavaScript at the end of the documentation. So we will see actually it's quite dramatic difference in terms of timing. Again, we're using F12 tools to measure that. And you will see the leave the JavaScript, of course, it depends on how big the JavaScript is, right? But based on our benchmark, our test is that particular JavaScript takes about over 400 milliseconds. So this is actually the page downloading. Think about 400 milliseconds is just for downloading that piece of JavaScript. That's quite a lot because you also have some other loading time like CSS and images, right? So think about this is quite a bit, 400 milliseconds. And then versus if you leave the JavaScript towards end, meaning I could get all the visual components like CSS, images loaded up front, then in that case, the response time is actually 84 milliseconds. So we're talking about 5 times faster just by putting the JavaScript at the bottom at the right position. So this is actually really something I think everybody should really watch out. This is going to be a killer if you don't do it carefully. Think about it, you may have one JavaScript, what do you have like 10 or 20 JavaScript, right? And what if your JavaScript size is quite big? This is going to impact your performance quite a bit. Okay, so the other thing is we talk about an inline style sheet. Is it a good idea to use inline JavaScript? Obviously, the answer is no, right? For the same, you know, context and the same idea. So in this particular sample, what we see here is we actually just did a little inline JavaScript, right? And then it's like a hello world. Of course, it's a little sample. But if you look at that, you just say, oh, this is not a good idea to put an inline JavaScript in the middle. And then this particular one, did you see something else wrong? This particular JavaScript is in the head. It's in the header. So it's even going to slow down the performance because we always say leave the JavaScript, link it towards the end, right? So first of all, putting the JavaScript in the bottom and then actually group that piece of inline code into an external JavaScript. And then because, you know, same reason, you work with inline sync because you need to introduce another container called JavaScript container. And then for the browser and engine, they can actually switch back and forth with HTML container versus a JavaScript engine container. And then switch back and forth, and then the impact will be even larger if we work with JavaScript container because it's JavaScript engine by itself. It's you know, non-trivial, right? It does occupy resource to do that. So always try to group the JavaScript into external file and never, never put it in the header.
And I will add a mileage may vary warning to this too. As with the data URI where you can take a very small image and encode it directly into your page to avoid the overhead of the HTTP request, the same can be said for some JavaScript. So there are limited scenarios where you may want to have inline code, but certainly not in the head. But I've seen it used for analytics snippets that you're including to track usage. A lot of times they'll have the bootstrapping code for that be used in an inline script towards the bottom of your page. It's pre-minified. I mean, it's not really human readable. But that's a case where the cost for that bootstrapping code, the HTTP request, would be more than just actually including it into your page. But generally speaking, leverage caching, leverage the benefits of CDNs for your scripts so you can avoid having to just inline them into your page like this.
Yeah. True. Okay, so we have JavaScript. And we know it could be pretty large. It could be, cost a lot of resource to do that. So what if we may not need that JavaScript, you know, in that particular moment, right? Is there any way we could actually download that piece of JavaScript asynchronously, right? So we could actually run it in the background. We don't have to actually loading it and block the UI thread. So this is actually something I think is very useful. And so what you do here is, in this slide, it will show you how easily you could do that. So you do everything just the way it is. And remember, always keep the JavaScript towards the end, right? And then instead of just doing a regular script and where the source is, you put a little keyword called async, right? Async. And then you could actually download that piece of JavaScript asynchronously. Now, we're talking about a very simple approach just to download the script asynchronously. Later on, when we talk about JavaScript initialization and other related things, JD actually have a lot to talk about.
Right. So with asynchronous scripts, if you had multiple scripts on the page, you would have script A, B, C, and D, and it would actually load them normally without async. It would load A first, and then B, and then C, and then D, and all of that while it's causing the page load to wait, so the final onload event to wait for them to be downloaded and that script to be parsed and executed. But with the async tag, you're saying, hey, script order isn't important, execution order isn't important. If you have script A, B, C, and D, and they are async, B may load before A, which may load after C, and it basically just says, hey, I just want the content to be loaded, but I don't care about the order, and I certainly don't want it to block the onload event on the page. And so async, whenever you're just needing supplemental JavaScript to make your page add extra functionality, or like I mentioned before, social media buttons or something, that's a great use for async.
Yeah. So use your async as much as possible. Now, we actually talk about some of the rules, some of the things you need to watch out. Let's actually show you a demo to help you understand all the strategies and principles we have been sharing with you. Now, this is Steve Souders' site. Some of you may heard about Steve Souders. He has two very good performance books, which I will share with you in the resource towards the end. And this is his site. It's called Kazillion. And you could actually easily try to, go back to the markup language we just talked about, and then try to arrange it and then load it to see what is the end result. So let's actually try to create a sort of like what we call worst sort of case scenario. Let's see what happened. So let's actually put some code. This is external JavaScript. And you could actually modify it, right? You could say, it is inside domain one, and then the response delay is going to be 2 seconds. We could probably just say, let's do it 4 seconds, right? And then we could save the setting, right? And then we could use some the inline style, right? Let's put it a style after the script, external script. And then we probably could do a little image. Right, let's put an image. All right, okay, so I have an image, style, inline style, and JavaScript. So let's actually take a look what's gonna happen. So create the image and see nothing really came out, right? The screen is blank for quite a long time until we see some response back, right? So obviously, like I said before, this is the worst case scenario. You could figure out why. I hope I could have already talked to you, but you probably see we actually put a JavaScript right in the header, right? So that it will block the UI thread, and we use the inline style there. And then, so there's multiple ways we could actually make it work better. So simply just do a quick fix. We could move the external script under the image towards the bottom of the page. And then we could even say, we know there's a multiple domain we could use. Remember the six concurrent connection, we could work with each domain. So I probably could say I use a different domain to get in my image resource, right? To save us a little bit. Let's save it and leave the rest of them the way it is. So let's actually do it again. Create a page. Uh-huh. Now what you see is your header bar. Partial screen is already displayed, right? And then it maybe does still take a little time to load the image and the JavaScript, but at least you see something, right? It won't be like the same first case is like a totally blank. I don't see anything. Maybe the site is dead. But here you see the header coming out, even though it's partial, right? But you know this app is working. So perceived performance, much better. So again, simple fix toward leave the JavaScript towards end is going to give you some good data. And then the other thing, if you want to do further optimization, you know, I don't know how well you could see it from this diagram, but you could actually change this JavaScript and just say, I'm going to use as add async That's a sync technique we actually talked about before. And then you could actually save it well. And then let's actually take a quick look. Very good. Actually, you see actually everything coming back, right, except that image still take a little
right.
time.
The entire page was able to load
right.
much faster, and
right.
then it was just the image resource coming in.
Right, right. right. And much better. So async keyword and async kind of approach does work in this case.
I would say that that is for modern browsers. If you're having
right.
to deal with
We're
old
using
browsers, oof, do some research on that.
Mm-hmm.
But for modern browsers, you're good to go with async.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And even with a modern browser, you know, a lot of like we purposely create a worst scenario. But if you try that worst scenario in the old browsers, you will see the performance is even worse. It's intolerable, right? So this is a good site, and you could always go there. And I actually saved the link in the GitHub. So if you go there, you open the README, you will be able to find the detail, and you could actually try yourself. So recommend you, if you want to play with that, by all means, try it. Okay, so we talk about all the different ways, different rules to putting different resources in the right place. Now we're going to actually talk about the duplicate code. All right, let's look at this example. Now, if you look at that, you probably look at it and just say, okay, it looks pretty ordinary. And okay, now you highlighted it, right? Okay, I know, you know, this is kind of obvious. I actually put a jQuery library twice, right? Because we, most of us like to use jQuery, you know, but this is kind of obvious, right? But think about it. If you have a huge long page and you have several subpage, and it's probably not that obvious, you probably would say, oh, I'm not quite sure if I include a jQuery library there or not. So let me put it there, put another copy. Regardless, if you check in the front or check in the some parent page, maybe you put that jQuery library there already, but you just say, oh, just for the safe side, let me put it there, right? Or sometimes you need to use multiple third-party libraries, and that third-party library is also using some other, say, jQuery as well. So you are actually loading multiple copy of jQuery again, without really, you know, be aware of that. And this is going to cost you quite a bit of resource, because this is really all the duplicated code you're working with, right? And this is totally unnecessary. If I put a sample like this, everybody knows says I should not use put a jQuery twice. But if the jQuery show up in different place, chances are, yes, you probably go back to check a code. I wouldn't be surprised if you tell me, Doris, I put a jQuery in three different places, which you really don't need it. It's possible.
I think it really is, especially when you're dealing with content management systems,
right.
or you have a big property that you may only control just the sidebar of this property, or maybe just a sub piece of a blog or something. And,
mm-hmm.
and if you're adding your little widgets or buttons or something to that piece, you may not know that there's other parts of the page that are loading various different versions of jQuery, so maybe like three or four versions.
Right.
And all of that, it's not only just the download, but it's also the bootstrapping and execution and initialization of the script too that's accounting and costing you page load time.
Very true. And then you look into the statistics for the duplicate code, right? I want to share with you. 52% of the page on the web have duplicated code. What does that tell you? More than half of us are not doing a good job. We're actually creating a bunch of duplicate code. Some of the duplicate code could get up to like more than 100 lines of code. And these are really, you know, especially jQuery example is very classical. Including us, we make that mistake all the time. So you just have to be careful, check your code and to reduce that. Next, it's kind of on a similar concept, but I want to actually share with you. I would say this year is really a big harvest of different kind of frameworks, right? We have Angular, Backbone, Ember, you know, all those kind of things. It's really start to getting web developers' attention, and we could actually use all of them, I would say, right? So you probably do, right? In your you want to experiment with, right? We all like to play with the new stuff, right? So you put all the frameworks right here, but you have to pay attention what's the nature of that framework. They a lot of times doing very similar thing. You put in there, maybe just only use maybe 10% of that library. But then you're basically wasting a lot of resource to loading it, to parsing it without really using it, right? So take a look at all the frameworks you try to use in your app. Try to standardize things and try to use on one single framework if you can. Right, so that's sort of like a rule number one. Second thing about that is, you see a lot of social media. You see a lot of different kind of library, like a Facebook, a Twitter, Google, and all those things. And sometimes you just want to impress somebody, whoever that person is, right? You just say, oh, I know how to do this, right? Let me actually include that cool library into my code. But then later on, when you move on to a production environment, you totally forget about that. You leave a bunch of a library just because they're kind of cool. You leave it there without even touching them, right? So we see that a lot. And you're actually wasting a lot of resource, right? To just include there, to downloading, to passing it. So not a good practice. Check your code. Remove the cool library. Remove the duplicated library. Stay with a single framework. Okay, so you probably would say, okay, I get an idea, but I still want to understand, how bad is bad, right? So I did a very simple benchmark. Let's take a look. So I have two very simple apps, and then we try two different scenarios. One is try to get all the different libraries, multiple frameworks. And then obviously this is, I did something bad. I cheated a little bit. I put it even in the header, right? And you see, I'm getting all the libraries, and which I may not need it, right? Like Angular, Scriptless, Prototype, Dojo, blah, blah, blah. And this is one way of doing things, right? And then the other is I didn't really use any JavaScript library except my own library, because I feel like it's enough for me to handle it without calling the third-party library. Okay, so let's take a look at the result. So we're running the multiple framework. And again, let's use F12 tools to capture some of the data. And then loading. It's a little rotation of the logos. Okay. So now we get our captured data. So what I'm more interested in is this is using the multiple framework. So I'm going to actually zoom the loading time and to show you what's really going on. So from the data, I'm not surprised to see. Obviously, we're getting a lot of JavaScript code here. It's taking a lot of CPU utilization. And we have a little garbage collection going on in the front. And we also have some loading and image decoding, like in the app. Okay, so this is what it looked like from the navigation until the page finished loading. Okay, so let's actually take a look what happened in that single framework, right? Let's put it side by side. It's exactly the same app. If you look at this app, you won't be able to tell if I'm using single framework or multiple framework. Okay, so reload it. Do you guys know how to do a force reload? Shift reload is always like a force reload, because sometimes you thought you reloaded it, but actually it doesn't. So that's just a small tip to share with you. Okay, so again, I'm taking down for that particular loading time and take a quick look. Okay, so what we see here is we see resource-wise, it's a lot less JavaScript code is loading. And then we also see a little garbage collection that's probably done in the beginning, which is consistent. But obviously, from here up to the loading time, we see the loading time is a little shorter, right? And it's about 54 milliseconds versus here. It's about, we could make it a little accurate. So it's about, is that right? Oh, I did something wrong. Sorry. I moved it too much.
It is substantially more, though, execution.
Yeah, so. It's actually, okay. Here we go. It's actually 291 milliseconds versus, that's about right, 54. Mm-hmm. Because this is a single framework, less traffic in the CPU, and this is a bunch of the scripting, loading, and the CPU time. Okay, so you get an idea. This is actually quite a substantial. It's almost like 6 times faster, right? So that's actually really cool to be aware of. Okay, so let's actually go back and move on. So we should know what your application is doing.
I'll pick up this module. So know what your application is doing. In this section, we're going to talk about timers. There's set timeout and set interval. Set timeout allows you to specify a callback to be executed at a time in the future, so milliseconds time in the future. Set interval allows you to do the same thing, but instead of it being called once, it's recurring at that timeout interval, so that millisecond interval. And so the chart here, the image here shows the set interval jump happening. So we can see that it's going and executing every in number of seconds. But there's a way to do that more efficiently in your applications with modern APIs like Request Animation Frame. So let's see here. In this example here, before we get into Request Animation Frame, I'll show you that just so you can kind of get the idea of milliseconds in timing, 60 frames a second, when that's broken down into milliseconds, is roughly 16 milliseconds. It's a little bit more, like 16.7 milliseconds. So in this example, you're doing every 6 milliseconds, it's executing a callback, every 10 milliseconds, and then every 50 milliseconds. And so you can see the larger gap in time, the less number of executions is happening of the callback. And this just says, hey, 16 milliseconds. Before Request Animation Frame happened, you would do something like set interval. But set interval and set timeout aren't optimized in the same way. So we can say Request Animation Frame instead. Request Animation Frame is unique in that it takes into account the rendering pipeline and can it tries to achieve, without you having to set a timer or a millisecond call, it tries to achieve 60 frames per second. So you can call it with Request Animation Frame, your render loop, over and over and over again, but it's only going to execute at max 60 frames a second. And also, it has a better sync with the rendering pipeline, so you can ensure that you're not causing invalidations and that it better syncs up with power utilization and efficiency. And so there's a nice demo that I'll show in I believe the next slide or the one after, that really hits this point home with efficiency and power use. So let's see. Before I get into that, though, there's other things. As the web has progressed, being able to detect when your tab is visible is important, because now we all have multiple tabs. We're all visiting websites and then having one in the back burner. But the thing is, when the page is not being viewed, you don't need to be processing that animation or that video game or have that script really churning away on the page whenever it's not being seen. So there is API available for you, so Page Visibility API, that allows you to detect when the page is hidden or when a page is visible, so you can pause that heavy activity. The timers, like Request Animation Frame, will automatically throttle for you based on if the frame is visible or not. Set timeout and set interval have also been modified to do that as well. So normally, when you switch tabs, it goes from something like a 4 millisecond granularity to like a 15 or 16 millisecond granularity automatically in newer browsers. So there are already, some of this stuff is kind of baked in for you. But if you need additional access to that, the Page Visibility API is also available for you. So here's the demo. This is the demo for Request Animation Frame. And you can see that with the set timeout, I'm going to set this execution at 1 millisecond. Now, in reality, as I mentioned before, there is a throttling that goes on, so 1 millisecond may not necessarily be 1 millisecond, but you can see that the CPU efficiency, the power consumption, and the background interference using set timeout versus Request Animation Frame is night and day. Low, it's basically the worst grade possible for set timeout versus the best for Request Animation Frame. So in modern browsers, you should really be utilizing a Request Animation Frame for your timing and animation APIs. Shift F5. Okay. So in summary, we covered how to stay lean and how to avoid intermediate object creation, explained what GC pauses were, how they affect your page. We discussed efficient markup and the structuring your markup efficiently, so moving your scripts to the bottom of the page, utilizing the async attribute, and also explained, hey, know what your application is doing, know the difference between set timeout, set interval, request animation frame. Anything else?
Yes, actually, we're going to actually apply those principles and strategies towards the very last module. We have a case study. We're going to actually show you how we could apply those things.